Accession number 10165, reel number 33.
Martin McLean, reel 33. How did you occupy your time then if you didn't play bingo housey-housey?
Well, apart from the training that we had to do on the ship, the marching, the weapon training, which I was always involved with, and the lectures and the talks, I made it my business to get to know these 140-odd men that I had placed in my care, in my company. I had a young officer called Lister Todd, whose brother was also in the battalion, and between us, we formed a plan that we'd get to know everyone in the company before we landed wherever we're going, destination next, just in case we're involved straight away in action. So I used to get a hold of the sergeants and sit them in the mess, sit them on the deck and talk to them about their background, their life, what they had done, what their qualifications were, and list them all so that I knew just what the man would do. And the same as I used to do with the new intakes to the company when I first had the rifle company. And then I would go down the mess deck and talk to the men as a group, and then I'd call them and say the junior NCOs, the NCOs, the corporals, the lance corporals, the same up on the deck in the blue skies, sitting on a hatchway or something, or sitting somewhere or leaning against the side of the ship, the rails of the ship, watching the dolphins busy in the front, and then talking to them about their background and enlisting them all so that I had a complete knowledge of every man in the company. Well, we had received a number of lads from Liverpool who objected to being in the Durham Light Infantry. But, you know, it's rather funny to say that, but they didn't like being moved from the regiment they were in. I don't know what regiment they were in, but a group of them from Liverpool. We had quite a number of them. In fact, I'd like to deviate just here for a moment. I keep in touch with the Kohima veterans, the men who did fight in Burma, and who go to an annual reunion with a 2nd Division regular. There's about 10 of them from Liverpool, and they're the most ardent Durham Light Infantry men you ever met in your life. Anyway, we had a number of lads from Liverpool, and it was difficult to understand what they were talking about, because they spoke in their own slang, like no doubt we did. The biker lads, we spoke in a very rough language. And getting to know everyone, and not sorting them out in the platoons into sections and making a nominal roll of everyone, and then placing the sergeants in the platoons, and then we got some officers who were from different places, and they were given platoons, so they eventually got to know the men, and everything was building up to a competent, efficient company. So we landed in Cape Town. Before we landed in Cape Town, the whole convoy hove to, you know, anchored off Cape Town, and it was, I don't know whether it's punishment for everybody aboard, because it's noted for its Cape Town rollers. Huge rolling waves come rolling in, big swells, and it brings the ship broadside onto the waves, not pointing to them, so it could cut through them. We're all idle, and the escort was out guarding us, and the ship start rolling, and the whole side of the ship was streaming with people vomiting and sick. Every available toilet, bathroom, everything was full of men being sick, violently sick, because the motion of the ship was so upsetting. They pulled us into Cape Town eventually, and they told us that everyone was going to be allowed ashore, and they had to be back by 9 o'clock at night. We're going ashore at 2 o'clock. Well, I had a great pal of mine, a fellow called Pat Brennan. He was Sergeant Major of D Company. We were lance corporals together, and he was a great gambler, was Pat. But we're friends. I was his best man at his wedding and godfather to his child, and he was the godmother. He came rushing in at me, Martin. He says, "Martin," he says, "have you any money?" I said, "Yes." He says, "Give us it." He says, "I've got a great hand. Can it be beaten? Great hand in a card school." So we always mucked in like that, funny enough. There's no question asked. I handed him maybe over my £5, which was a lot of money them days. Pat come back, he'd lost a lot. So we landed up in Cape Town. We had about the price of 2 pints between us. Now, as the ship landed, people were allowed off. And alongside the ship, there was a woman singing a welcome to the troops. And there was hundreds of motor cars, and people waiting for to take the lads off to their homes to give them a treat. This is South Africa. This, to me, was a great reception. I think hundreds and hundreds of people that were on the ship were put in cars and whisked away to welcome a party, to booze, to a reception at a person's house. All the cars had gone by the time Pat and me got off the ship. We had no point in going out. We thought we'd have a look, walk around Cape Town and see the main places. The one place we did go and see was the post office, peculiar place, large place, but they had the ceiling all done up with stars. I can't remember now whether it was lit up, but you could see the stars, the formation of the stars above the building. And it was very interesting. We wandered around, went to a pub and had a drink. And we were early back to the ship. Well, when we went back to the ship, it was on the gangplank. The military police were there, in force, on the ship. I said, what's this for? They wouldn't tell us. But every man that was late, every officer and man that was late, after 9 o'clock, his name was taken, and he was told that he'd be on punishments. Now, for some unknown reason, now the men weren't told about this, but they were told me back. This was the brigadier's idea. Smythe, they called the brigadier. He had everyone who came in late after 9 o'clock, it could be 7 o'clock, it was a pretty early time. And when you consider all the lads had been taken off by a car and treated to different people's houses and having to tear themselves away from this lovely accommodation that they were in, it was difficult for them to be back in time, I should say. But anyway, there's hundreds of them late coming back. So the next morning, the orders are passed out, through me, to pass to the men and to the officers that was late. All the names are given off. That from now on, they'd be on punishment stations. Every moment of their time from travelling to our destination, still Destination X, by the way, they'd be on training, drill, Ren gun training, all sorts of work on the ship. And officers and men all had to be treated the same. And so when we were relaxing, the officers were working and the men who were on this punishment, which we thought was a bit unfair, but never mind, it was the brigadier who ordered it, and they were on punishment right till we landed at Destination X.
Was there any speculation by now, when you're going to Cape Town, about where you were going? Were people,
Yes, we're all wondering. Singapore was being threatened at the time, and we thought that's where we're going for. When we landed up on the top of the ship, as I said, the red caps were there. There's another big blackboard notice. All ranks prayed, field service marching order, sea kit bag, leave your balance air kit, prayed at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I formed the company off, and off we marched off the ship onto trains, the local trains, and they took us off to a place called Retreat Camp. And there it was to give us a chance to do some marching, exercise, get our landlubber's legs back again, and to really get settled in.
Where was
that? Retreat, they called the place.
Where did you land?
In Cape Town. It was a suburb of Cape Town. They took us out by train to this place, and lo and behold, as we got off the train and marched up a ramp, there was another great friend of mine, RSM Roy Armstrong. He was RSM, he wasn't RSM when I knew him. RSM, this place that we're going to, he's RSM, this convalescent camp. And blow me, their commanding officer was an old Durham Light Infantry man, Lieutenant Colonel Goldsmith. And they're there, all there to welcome us. And Roy Armstrong says, I want to see you, Martin, later on. And he arranged a party for us to go out. Now, this is a bit of a story, this one. We all got settled into camp. We were put in tents. Well, it didn't matter, we slept in the open or anything. The sunshine and the warmth is so terrific. We're given tents with their sides well rolled up. And then the black people employed by the army came round with great big bunches of black grapes and bananas and fruit. Well, we needed it because we'd been aboard ship for a while. We're still getting nutritious food on the ship, but I think they thought we needed more fruit. And we're getting bunches of grapes and oranges and apples, and all the lads thoroughly enjoyed them. Well, Roy Armstrong, referred to Roy because he was the RSM of the place, he was told that we couldn't go out with him. He'd arranged a party for us. No, do. were all confined to this area. So he went and saw his command officer, who was camp commandant, and they got permission of the area commander for us to go off to this house in South Africa with Roy for a party. In other words, to meet some, Roy's friends, who are just normal, ordinary, working class type of South African. And we had a canny little party there. We got back to camp all right. We had a canny drink. One sandwich just misbehaved himself, and we had to put him under control. And got back to camp. Anyway, we were there about 5 days, marching, going out, doing things infantry have got to do. One day we'd done a great long march, and we came onto the beaches in South Africa, don't know where. We're in between Simonstown and Cape Town, somewhere in that area. And we landed on some of these beautiful beaches, and the order was given you can swim. Well, they had these big rollers coming, you know. Well, I was an awful bloke for swimming in water. I was a strong swimmer. I went in this water, and the waves crashed me straight down into the pebbles at the bottom. And I came out, my legs and everything were bleeding. But, you know, you learn not to go out too far. You had to keep out of the... You had to stay just in the surge of the water, not go out deep. Well, I went out deep, and I got punished for me trouble. Well, that was all very well. We enjoyed that, our swim, and we had a meal there. They brought some more food up for us. We basked in the sunshine for about a couple of hours, and they said, right, harness up, we're on the move again. Do you know, the daftest thing anyone can do is to go for a swim when you're on a march, because the water and the swimming just swimming your muscles. And it's a crucifying march, the rest of the part, the way back to retreat camp. I went through crucifixion. I should have known this, because I had the same thing in the regular army in Catterick, where we went for a swim and then started marching, but you forget these things. I hobbled into camp, I'm sure. One of the worst marches as a sergeant major I ever done. We got back to this camp. We're there about 5 days, and then we're back on the ship, and the ship pulled out. Now, the ship was such a fast one, they decided to send it independently, the rest of its voyage on its own. Still Destination X.
And these men were still on punishment?
Yes, all the time. Yes, they came back from the retreat camp. They were still on punishment. And we went off to... went on the ship, and it pulled out. And there was farewells. This woman was singing to us again, this farewell song. And she was noted... somebody's got a book up with her. And they've got all the names of all the different regiments that passed through that she gave a greeting to. This is only in the last 5 years, so there's a book being produced about her. And everybody got a welcome when they went to Cape Town. That's what surprises me about it today, you know. We'll say no more about that. I'm not going to get involved with that. And off we shot. On our own, with no escort at all. This big liner, really steaming, really full out. We were doing our submarine watch more vigilant than before, because we had no escort ships around us. And we shot off, and the next place we land up is in Bombay. Another strange place, Bombay, with the smells coming. As soon as you come into the port, you could smell it. A very overcrowded city, humid, low, and completely different to Cape Town. And everybody is agog, watching the ship coming in and tying up. And then we're sent for, company sandwiches. We're staying on the ship another night, but we're going to let parties of men under company surveillance off the ship. Now, there's a swimming pool being placed at our disposal called Beach Candy. Now, as a matter of fact, it was 2 years ago, it was on television. It used to be the white man's swimming pool in Pune, and they were allowing the troops to use it. And we went, what, a march off to Beach Candy, and have a swim there, if we wanted to swim, all days around. It was a really nice place with lawns, with tent, umbrellas for tents and tables, and a nice restaurant and things like that. And you could buy beer and things. And we got in there and had a good swim. Enjoyed ourselves, as a matter of fact. I had some great photos of that taken there. And Bob Bulmer, the lad I tell you about, who died, who was with me in France, he got all the photos. He was making an album. When you're talking in this vein, you know, your mind races ahead and you do forget things which may be of importance, not importance, but it all makes part of what goes on in the army. When at Cape Town, when I called the roll of my company, I found that I had one man absence, and another man was absent in another company, and they were both Liverpoolians. And the ship was searched for them, and they couldn't find them. The crew of the Empress of Canada were Liverpoolians, and these lads had apparently been getting on well with them. But mind, we saw some funny little incidents on the ship with the Liverpoolian crowds chasing the nurses and having to be repulsed away from the nurses. They were sex mad, and two men were absent, and we had to be reported. I'd just like to just harbour on that for a moment.
Yeah.
These two men we heard no more about. We know they were picked up in Liverpool in England months later on, and were sent to detention. Years later on, I was still in the army. I was down in London for my niece's wedding, and I went into a pub with my brother, and who did I meet but this man? And he was telling me about being in Durham's and this, that, and the other. And I said, yes, you were the man who deserted, weren't you? And he vanished. But that was him. But he didn't know what you could do. He'd done his punishments. That was the end of it. Anyway, we landed in India, and we were all agog again, a strange country, strange people, and very primitive. Plenty horse and carts, horse-drawn carriages, lots of bicycles, lots of barefoot people. Well, the image of the India of today, where they all wear suits and clothing, was not there. They wore their linen dress, like a sari wrapped around themselves, the women much the same, and they were very primitive. And you see the men sitting on the street sides chewing betel nuts, and in front of them there's huge pools of red juice where they've been spitting a betel, I think it's called betel, we call it betel nuts, out. And they looked at us curious, because we're all white-kneed, being first time overseas, you know, and were a little bit more colour because we'd been on the ship getting sunburned. But you could see we're brand new recruits, you know, into India. Now, the funny part of all this, we landed in India, and the Indian government didn't want us. Now, the whole division was coming, and the Indian government didn't want us, because they said they were going to feed 1,500 mouths of people that they didn't want, they hadn't asked for. We were being imposed upon them. And we were shoved off to a camp called Aminaga, about 50 or more miles outside of Pune. And the whole division was concentrated up in that area. And the Indians showed their reluctance to have anything to do with us. At first, there was difficulty in getting paid. And then when they paid us, eventually we got money through. I don't know what was going on behind the lines, but we were getting the reports about the reluctance of the Indian government to accept the division for feeding and paying and everything. Because once they were on Indian soil, paying become the responsibility of the Indian government. Wages and things like that. This went on for quite a long time. In fact, we carried on with training and marching. They objected to so much petrol being used by our MT, or transport, that was such an expensive commodity in India, that it was decided that they would give us bullock carts, these bullock carts to pull our company guns and weapons and things like that. Now, unbeknownst to them, that was the finest thing they ever done to an infantry battalion, giving them these horse bullocks, because they were slow marchers, they're slow walkers. Another thing, compulsory, they were great, fat, beautiful beasts bred by the army for this special purpose. And beautiful, gleaming bullock carts. Not like the dirty, mucked-up ones that you see wandering the streets, but these were magnificent-looking rays. Great white bullocks, or brown ones, that invariably the two colours. They had to be halted for 2 hours, every 4 hours. They had to stop, so we had to stop as well. Whereas normally we were marching, we might get a 10-minute break and on and on. So the CO got sick of this, because it taking us so long to get to our destination. They decided that with the bullocks, unlike as a company, the company weapons would march with you. we'd carry our Bren guns and weapons, and that the bullocks would follow on later on in their own steady style if we're going to make a billet anywhere. But they dispensed with the bullock carts, and we used to chuckle at the idea of going out with the bullocks, because we're all keen marchers, but we're not volunteers for marching. If we could get rest in the sunshine, we're doing it. Anyway, it didn't last very long, that. Another thing, when we landed out in India, we had all these Indian wallahs with us. The people who had been to India, I told you before that the 2nd Battalion had been to India 22 years, and now we had quite a number of them who'd called up as reservists in the battalion, mainly the Sergeant Majors. They were ex-India wallahs. Come dinner, no work. Everybody into charpai. Charpai is the bed. Everybody sleep for 2 hours. Everybody into bed. That was great, another great thing. And it started carrying on with the train. No, when we're out on the train, no train in the afternoon. Well, I says we're not going to get very far training like this. Because to me, the weather was suitable for to do training, you know. But you must wear your topi at all times, or else you get sunstroke. It protects the back of the neck. All these stories emerging from all the people in the division who had been to India before, the rules and regulations they kept. But somebody higher up suddenly took a cotton under this and said, we are wasting time here. So they said, right, forget that. Every man will strip off to the waist, out in the sunshine, on sport every afternoon, hockey, football. And we used to love this. But before we were confined to billets, confined to bed, you had to stay in bed. Now we're all getting hard enough for the sun, getting sunburned, getting to know the country, getting some of the fat off us from the good feeding off the ship. And that is how the training started, progressed in the first, when we first went to India, but it sharp changed. We're on full training from there on. Out on long exercises, long marches, the sweat dripping off the end of our noses. Well, we wore our shirts when we were a full march in order, and we're doing exercise now. It was at Amanaga when we first start learning this new idea of battle drill. I went on a course.
Tell me about the course.
I went on a local course run by army instructors on this new idea of battle drill. Well, a battle drill was simply a scheme of controlling the sections in action better than we had been used to, you see. In the old days, we had the section cluttered around you all the time. There were then pebble formation, Bren gunners, and we used to work with the 12 men around us all the time in close contact, which made a bigger target. It's only common sense. With a Bren gun, if one got hit, a number got hit. Apart from that, battle train wasn't really intended for that. It was intended for a deployment of troops and advancement over into the attack with fire from your own men, allowing fire and movement, as they called it. And so the tortoises battle drill, like you'd have your Bren group, the Bren gunner would be called the Bren group, and your other half section would be the riflemen. And if you're attacking a position, you'd work in sections. You'd send your Bren gunner, who was handicapped by carrying such a heavy load, off to a suitable position where you could inflate your attack by fire onto the enemy post. And you'd work around and find some cover, and then you would eventually attack these positions in leaps and bounds, with the Bren gunners pinning down the heads, or that's what was expected, to pin down the heads of the enemy while you made your attack and final assault. And they paid great emphasis on this. I found it was a good thing, in actual fact, the whole of the war. I thought it had been a good thing to learn this battle drill. Somebody had put the heads together and thrown away the old handbooks which was our Bible, and devised a new system whereby troops would be more useful on the ground than just running forward and block with Bren guns and the lot. And then we came back and taught the company and the battalions this. It was interesting, everybody enjoyed it, so everything was stopped while we learned this battle drill for about a week. And then back on training once again. Now, then came out that we had been intended for Singapore, but Singapore had fallen. Now, this wasn't actual fact. It was whispers coming down from higher up. Singapore had fallen. They had no place to put us, so they put us in India.
How long were you at Amanaga?
We'd be... Well, The intention was to keep us there a long time, because we had now been earmarked as an amphibious division with an intent by Army Command. We were to train as an amphibious division. This is another grapevine thing, which is very strong. We were to do attacks in Italy, in Sardinia, and in places, amphibious attacks. That was our whole intent now, to be an amphibious battalion. So they took us off to a place called Caravasla, outside of Pune, by different battalions. I don't know if there's brigades, and there were some 5th commanders up there. Now, the 5th commander had done a stunt in India and finished up in China, around by the Burma roadway, and they selected their WOs and NCOs to take us on amphibious training. Seamanship, as they called it. So we went up this big lake in Caravasla, and they had some rowing boats there. And the rowing boat was just like an ordinary ship's lifeboat, but without the oars. They had a handle which used to pull, like, back and forward. And run. It used to be connected onto a rod which run along the length of the ship, driving a propeller. So when you pull it, instead of an engine driving the boat, it was manpower that was driving it, driving the propeller at the back. On the lake, it was great. We used to do these amphibious things, and then they'd stop you using these handles, and they'd make you do the proper drill with the oars. Oars, stand by to give way together, and all this seamanship that the Navy done, you know. And then we'd do attacks, platoon attacks, section attacks, company attacks, on the other side of the thing, night and day. And we learned to do all sorts with seamanship. Now, they had built up on the side of the lake a mock-up of a ship, so that when you took post to get on your boat, you were more or less like you'd be on a ship, like we used to do on the Empress of Canada lifeboat drill. We used to file up in front of the special boats that we were designated to with our life belts, life jackets on, ready to go on. Well, and same on this little Angostura, they called the ship. Somebody had nicknamed it. And HMS Angostura, and we used to line up and get on our boats and pull off and go and do our exercise. It was all interesting stuff, this, to us. But we spend our time learning knots, learning rope lashings, learning seamanship, swimming in the water. The water was too deep to teach the non-swimmers, so we were confined to swimmers only in the water. We're doing night exercise, and then we came back to our billets back at we went back to Amanaga again, and other units, you know, they're feeding them in so many times to do this.
So this was just a course?
This was just a course for the teacher's seamanship. Now, they took us off to another place in India. What's the name of it? The name will have to come back to us. Where there was a lot of water in the jungle, and now we're going to learn jungle training, mainly through mud flats and in the jungle itself. Well, we're being introduced to the jungle here what's the name of the place? And I've known it all the time. We start doing marches with compass, learning to find our way through jungle. It was pretty thick stuff. There was hills, and it was not a flat place. Plenty of hills. There was a river run past it. Plenty of water. For watermanship, we're doing a little bit of watermanship with the rubber dinghies, like the land off the submarines. Two-man or three-man boats rowing in and carrying people ashore and dumping some and going back for others. All this little bit of practice as long as we're on water. But the really thing that was outstanding, in my opinion, was learning the map reading, which I was pretty good at map reading because I had a day distinguished for map reading in peacetime. You didn't have to take it first, but I went for map reading and got it distinguished. Now, it was all map reading and compass work. Now, every platoon commander had a compass. He could use it, he could point at a thing, but then the next thing was to allow for the magnetic variation on the compass. And so you had to get your map, work out the magnetic variation, and march to certain spots that were given to you. Maybe for the start of us by joining to a roadway or joining anywhere, something big. And they got so good at this map reading that we had a competition in my company once. And it was to go to a single tree that somebody knew about, somebody that planned the scheme. It was a